And we are back. And back with us tonight is one of America's great people, Clifford Carnicombe. He is what I call a citizen scientist. He has done more to help us understand aerosol spraying, otherwise known as chemtrails, and now Morgellons than any team of people could ever do. And he's going to bring us up to date tonight on a lot of very interesting things, and I'm very honored to have him back. He is an extremely busy man. We're going to talk about blood issues, Morgellons, a status report, and some future research topics as well. Clifford, are you there?
I sure am, Jeff. Thanks very much for the opportunity to be here again tonight.
Always a pleasure, sir. It goes back many years, and you're still at it. I'm amazed.
It does now. We've got close to a deck. Well, we've got 11, 12 years coming up pretty soon.
Wow. Okay, the last time you were on, we talked about a number of actually mind-bending issues, and if you want to touch on those briefly before we move on to tonight as a primary venue, go right ahead.
Thank you very much, Jeff, and thank you also very much for devoting your continuous effort to these subjects. Also, we have so many subjects that are important to us, and I know this is only one of many, but I really appreciate your continuity.
My pleasure.
And dedication, devotion over the years on this. I thought we would take just a few minutes. You know, I remember on the last interview we did, which I think was in September, we focused on a research paper that was written by a geneticist and a chemist. And that was well covered, I think. And so I'm not going to go over that again other than make a reference to it. And then, if I recall correctly, at the tail of the interview, we brought up a couple subjects, which were actually quite important. We had just a couple minutes. And I just wanted to sort of reiterate those issues. I really don't think we're going to have time to go over those in any kind of detail because there is even more substance, I think, that has developed since that time. But I did want to make a reference to them and then get into the heart of a main paper for tonight and then end with, I know, what will be a very passing glimpse of many, many serious issues that have emerged very quickly, actually. In the last couple of weeks, even.
Oh, really? Oh, all right. Well.
But in our last interview, from what I can gather, was I think it was in September of this year, so not as long as we have waited sometimes, so I really do appreciate that. Back to this interview of last time, we talked about a paper by Richard Smith, and really the main point I want to make is we talked about a paper which conducted by all appearances, a proper and formal laboratory analysis of filament samples, biological filament samples, that were associated with the Morgellons condition. And the result of that paper was actually rather astounding to me, and I had uncovered it. It looks like at least a couple of years had passed before I that paper was brought to my attention through one of the members of the institute I'm involved in. And that paper was pretty astounding because it had some very specific and definitive information in it about what was involved. And specifically, it mentioned a blood protein that was in that filament in significant quantities.
Mm-hmm.
It had mentioned the existence of keratin, mm-hmm. Which has become more and more interesting over time. Keratin is a protein that's similar to basically our hair, a very hard substance, difficult to break down under most cases. And over the years, we see that this actually has, it looks like, a great deal of significance as an external carrier or sheath of what is going on inside that is much more complex and generally usually hidden from view. But he had the keratin mentioned. He had the albumin mentioned, a blood protein, and then he had an unidentified fluorescent protein, if we recall, and he very specifically stated that this could not be matched with any human protein. Now, the only point I want to make tonight is that, you know, at the time that article was written, at least a couple of years had passed, and this individual had sent that information to a university that had the proper resources to identify that protein, and nothing had happened by the 2 years, you know, that I had discovered the paper. And the point I want to make tonight is that, you know, another 3 months have passed since we discussed this, brought attention to it, And to my knowledge, again, I can be mistaken, but to my knowledge, there is no further information on the identification of that specific protein that was mentioned as a glaring need in that report and was sent to a sophisticated laboratory. I believe it's Oklahoma State University. And to my knowledge, nothing has transpired or no information has been made public on that identification. So I'm bringing this up because over and over and over, we're going to keep seeing these fundamental questions that have emerged. And it's not a matter of once. They're emerging over and over and over. And there is still no satisfactory response to very obvious and glaring issues. And that is one that did make it into the laboratory. That was, you even had a strong basis to work from and mm-hmm. still unfinished. And as we go along tonight, I think that we have repeating themes over a decade mm-hmm. that are of the same magnitude, if not even greater, than a specific protein analysis. So that's the point that, to my knowledge, nothing has progressed on that issue. And okay. the need is as paramount now as it was 3 months ago when you and I spoke. And I hope that people will refer back to that interview to recall the specifics and details of it. The other two topics that came up in between the paper that you and I are going to concentrate on tonight, we made a passing mention. Made passing mention of, I believe. And the first one had to do with the identification of erythrocytic forms, blood cell forms,
mm-hmm.
Within a cultured sample. Now, the cultured sample comes from the gum area, the dental area, using a wine test that many of us are familiar with now.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very, very simple.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a matter of swishing that around. And but there was I'm trying to see if this one had decomposition. The title of this paper was Blood Issues Intensify, and this did not have a decomposition process take place that we're going to take forward later. This was the original culture form in wine from a dental sample. And the point of this paper was that there were two specific forensic-level tests that were done over a period of several months that gave a positive result on the identification of hemoglobin within those culture samples. So this issue of erythrocytes that we've been talking about now for 10 years is one of these issues that keeps coming back, and it's at a very, very serious level. And we're long past the days of wondering whether there's an issue here or not. We have a body of evidence over a decade now to the level of forensic tests that show the existence of these blood cells or erythrocytes within the cultured environments.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, that's another major accomplishment here. It just is. The fact that we are now in the position where this material can be cultured gives us a laboratory setting and some degree of control now
right.
over the examination of the materials that we're speaking of.
For our listeners, Clifford, going back to your early research of gathering air samples and so forth, what is the tie-in for our listeners between the air sample, the aerosol contaminants that you were able to find, and what we're talking about tonight? Is there a direct line?
Well, this is one of our main issues for tonight, and I'll go into it in more depth later
okay.
on. But there has been, first of all, there has been the detection of erythrocytes or red blood cells in airborne samples now close to a period of 10 years.
Right.
Okay? So this was occurring.
Now, I have to interrupt one more time, please.
Yeah.
Are these erythrocytes the same as are found in the average human being, or are they different?
We don't know. You know, it's a great question. We don't know those details yet, and in fact, that's the other paper that I wanted to make a brief reference to before we got into our main topic tonight,
okay.
and that was this paper that was called Artificial Blood. Mm-hmm. And then there's a question mark out of after,
right.
Okay?
Right.
This is sort of my response to your question. I have written a whole paper which shows the extraction and development of this erythrocytic form from these cultures. And it's not clear whether they are, let's say, human or not. I will say it was titled Artificial Blood because there is a very strong indication mm-hmm. that those things are too perfect to be human blood.
Wow.
They have a very, very perfect geometry, no aberrations of any kind, and the conclusion of that paper was that we need to consider it as a potential artificial form.
In other words, somebody built it. And
it's quite, it looks quite possible that this thing is synthetic in some way, at that part of it. There's different
and
levels, but at that part.
For those of you listening, you are hearing correct information here, and Clifford confirmed it. He discovered it, that these perfect erythrocytes were found in air samples in New Mexico. I don't know how many other locations. What are they doing in the air?
Well, those are from the cultured samples, Jeff, just so you know.
Okay,
those artificial are from a cultured form.
All right, got it. But we did find similar in the air. Be right.
Absolutely.
Okay, back with Clifford Kernicom. So again, just to reiterate what I was mentioning as we went into the break, yes, Clifford found blood cells, desiccated or otherwise, in aerosols, air samples, in the air. Okay, let's just keep it real simple and rudimentary. Over 10 years ago, I guess now, Clifford, that's a long time. So what are blood cells or blood cell-like objects doing floating around in the air? How did they get up there? These are questions that remain to be satisfactorily and firmly answered, but they are very important questions. So please go ahead, Clifford.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Jeff. And I think we're actually going to come back to a couple of the questions that you brought up earlier through the night. And I'm thinking that in terms of planning, I'll try to allow about an hour to get through this main paper that's the subject of tonight, and then about a half hour, the last half hour or so to 45 minutes on those future research topics, which are going to be very important that we get through that because it's actually going to come back to your question about airborne samples, and we do need to make that tie. So I'll do my best on timing. But for now, I think it's time to relax a little bit. I have a lot of information here that I'm trying to sort out in terms of what's a logical way to present this. But there's a paper that I wrote now in the beginning of October called Morgellons, a Status Report. And this paper came about because there was what I would call a breakthrough in the culturing process that revealed many aspects to this that could not be seen before. And because of that, quite a few discoveries emerged within a fairly short time period. And this paper, yeah, hopefully it's fairly well organized, but as I see this, it's like just item after item after item was coming out from this work, and there's something like 20 points on this paper. And we could take all night, I think, actually going through these. Mm-hmm. We won't have time to, so mm-hmm. I'm going to try to pick those that are most important for us. Mm-hmm. And there's two ways I can go about this. This paper has a textual component to it where it's listing these items that to me I would regard as important. And then there's a series of photographs. And I really don't know the perfect way here because they are both important. They both complement one another. So I suspect we'll cross between both of them. But that I'll start with the photographs if any folks are able to get a hold of this paper and see it visually as we're talking. Obviously, pictures are easier and quicker to understand than the language, but the language is probably going to become important as we go along, so I'll try to cross between them. But I'd like to sort of relax with this paper and take it from the beginning and describe what it is that is being shown here. And there's somewhat of a chronology taking place that shows an evolution that has taken over a decade, and it's really unfortunate and sad, honestly, that it has taken that long to get to this point, but nevertheless, that is what we are faced with. And so I'll start with the pictures here. And what we have at the top of this of the photograph section are some photographs of samples from the mouth and some wine cultures.
Okay, we want to direct people to the pictures for sure. So click on Clifford's name, and go to carnicum.com. Is that where you want us to go, Cliff?
Yeah, that'd be fine. Just go to the front page, and you'll see a main topic there that says Morgellons, a status report.
It's right there in the middle above
the right in the center with its own headliner.
Chemtrail pictures, right. That's where I am. I want everybody to be there. Okay.
And I appreciate if you're there, too, because it will help
I'm here.
Us, because I want to make sure that we do answer questions, like I say, because I think there might be something.
Very good. Looking at photographs right now.
Right, and these photographs are near the bottom of this page, and probably have a couple dozen or a dozen and a half to get through. Now, the beginning of those photographs, they show some of the early samples that were developed in the culture medium. And one of the photographs just shows the material that comes from the mouth. And most people that have done this test with the wine realize that they are producing this material. In fact, I actually don't have any exceptions to that at this point. And that's that photograph to the top right. And it's very ugly. There's no way around it. It's like a mass of material. And you know, this is not a precipitation. I'm familiar with those kind of claims that are being made. This is not a precipitate. This is a filament, okay, that's emerging from the mouth when exposed to red wines. And that's another question that's going to come up here. Many, many, many questions are coming up. But just the wine chemistry that's involved here, and why wine happens to be working in certain ways, both for extraction as well as culturing, is a fascinating question in itself. But we have this physical material, which just about anybody seems to be able to verify that they produce. Now, the top left photo shows this material placed in wine. Now, and one beneath it shows it placed on an agar medium. And actually, the work started on the agar medium. That takes a long time. When things are in a solid form, it's harder to work with. But that was the first breakthrough, was when this material was put onto an agar medium. Indeed, it did grow a culture. And then the first thing that we learn is that if we examine that growth, it is identical to the filaments that come from the mouth. So we have a reproduction, a growth of the material, and the means to develop and control that in a laboratory setting. So that's a first important level of progress. That's on agar. Now, the top one is in wine, and this is one of those, whether you call it serendipitous or not, it's certainly accidental, but there's no reason in the world that I know of that you would think or even ask the question or try to develop a culture in wine particularly.
Okay, very good. Stand by. We'll pause. Take a look at the pictures, and this is a very comprehensive and fascinating display that we're looking at. Again, Science by Clifford Carnicum, and some extraordinary discoveries that maybe certain people in certain places would rather he not be making. But here they are, pictures, proof, the works. We'll be right back. Okay, let's get right back to our conversation with Clifford Carnicum, looking at photos of a very, very important nature here. Go ahead, Clifford, please. And again, your comment was that this was a filament and not just a piece of old food or something is very important. So go ahead.
Yeah, that's right. These are definitive filament samples without any question. And, you know, I realize that there are many different aspects to these problems that we're facing in this particular issue of Morgellons. But remember, unfortunately, it broadens out and does include aerosol aspects, whether we like it or not. It looks like that link is pretty darn strong to me from what I see. I know there's a lot of different aspects to this, and I do not claim to have all the answers. And it is pretty clear that I am focused on two, let's say, particular themes, one involving the blood and one involving these particular filaments and their nature. And the reason that I'm doing that, just so that people know, is because I am seeking to act at a level that appears to be a common denominator, regardless of the level of manifestation of outward symptoms that is occurring. In other words, that filament sample at the top right that we're looking at, the reason that thing even came into being was through an individual. She actually makes no secret of it at this point. Dr. Gwen Scott is the one that discovered that a technique. She is to be given credit for it. And she is an individual that has clearly stated that she manifested these symptoms. And at this point, we're talking about visible, strong skin, outward symptoms, okay? And so she was a subject, one of many, but one who had pronounced symptoms, who was the basis for the discovery of the internal filaments.
Okay.
Now, from her work, it was extended to consider other subjects that do not display skin manifestation.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a result of this work where I have, let's call it inferred or concluded, either way you would like to, but I would conclude that the skin manifestation is not at all a sufficient condition or criteria to establish the existence of this condition. Because in those examinations involving random subjects as well as those that manifested symptoms, there are common denominators occurring in both blood anomalies as well as the existence of this filament material internal to the body. And those manifestations appear, with the best information I have available, to be affecting the general population, not an exclusive class. And so this is why I am so focused on these two particular aspects, because I regard them at this point to be common denominators that require a basis, a foundation of examination. And I realize that there are many other individuals reporting other levels and other manifestations. It's just that I can't operate at that level yet until we clear up some very fundamental questions that are occurring at what I would say is a common level in the general population.
Now let me spend just a moment on that. What Clifford is suggesting is that Morgellons, as an overall agent in the population at large, is common. And it is not only diagnosed sufficiently by looking at someone's skin for lesions, for fibers, and so forth. Now, we've been saying that from the beginning, that filaments, fibers, and other manifestations of what Morgellons is or appears to be are probably rife throughout the body, in the brain, in the liver, in the lungs, in the kidneys, you name it, in the bloodstream. And people who do dark field microscopy are finding things that they never saw 10 years ago. They don't know what they are. There is some bizarre and fundamentally odd manifestation going on in the human body on a very large scale in this country and probably around the world, which may or may not be tied in directly to the skin portion of the Morgellons syndrome. It probably is. But my feeling after studying this for years from a layman's perspective, not a scientist like Clifford, is that the skin manifestation may be one of the latter stages of this infestation. It's not a primary, I don't believe. And when you have a skin manifestation, you can certainly expect with a reasonable certainty and likelihood that these fibers have penetrated pretty much your entire body. And that's just my very crude and rudimentary summation of things as I see them.
Thank you, Jeff, and it's not crude and rudimentary at all. It's very accurate from anything that I know and see from everything I've studied on this. You know, I went to a talk this last week, which is really rather fascinating, but it was by a medical doctor, longstanding, and this individual was talking on the liver, and she made a comment there that just caught my interest, and it relates to what we're talking about. And she made the statement that the skin is an excretory organ. Now, that's actually fascinating because it sure makes sense. It's true. Our skin is an organ that excretes toxins. And I would concur and agree completely that the indications I have are that if this material is coming out of the skin, that is simply an outer manifestation of attempts by the body to excrete a toxic form. Mm-hmm. And everyone may not agree with that. It's just what I think the evidence indicates thus far, because Mm-hmm. If you dig deeper on any of those individuals that manifest skin symptoms, it does appear as though there is a pattern of anomalous blood that is at a greater degree than those that are not manifesting.
And we still, aside from Jan Smith and her knee joint surgeries, she had her knees replaced, we don't have any really blue chip autopsy documentation of this syndrome in the inner portion of the body. And we should have that. We need that. Unfortunately, no one can really volunteer for that while they're still alive and above room temperature. But we do need autopsies. We do need forensic work to find out if what Clifford is finding in the mouth and what people are pulling out of their skin and what was in the middle of Jan Smith's knees is indeed penetrating throughout the body. I believe there's no question it is. You'd have to be silly to think otherwise.
The work is already showing that this material is crossing major systems of the body. Any notion that it's just in the gums or the teeth is actually completely false. The urinary system has been involved, saliva, the blood, really everything indicates it is the body systems that are infiltrated. And it would be erroneous to think that we happen to have a localized region just in the teeth and the gums.
Very good. All right, stand by. We're taking a look at Morgellons through the eyes and the genius of Clifford Carnicom. And we'll continue our conversation in just a few minutes. Okay, back with Clifford, and we're taking a look at Morgellons, which obviously continues to spread unchecked, unnoticed by what they call the mainstream and all news media, except for this program primarily, and what Clifford puts out on his website and a few others. It remains below the radar, so far below you'd almost need a microscope to see it. The CDC continues to obfuscate and lie about it, nothing coming from them of substance, and we don't expect anything. We do believe that they probably know far more than we do, but they're not about to say it, just like we watch the World Health Organization now sitting on the viral genetic sequences from Ukraine. They're lying. They will not release them. So nothing new there, and that's why the work of Clifford Carnicom and others is so crucially important. We have to do it. Can't rely on the government. We know who they are now. Please go ahead, Clifford.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Back to these photographs then now. So we've seen the base material that we're starting with. And then we brought up the fact that if you put this material, this filament material, which comes from internal to the body, it's not just the gum, but it comes internal from the body. If you place that material in wine, of all things, there is a surprising result. And it is that in addition to agar, that wine is a suitable medium for the reproduction and growth of this filament. Now, whether it's an accidental discovery or not, I can't say, but it was certainly peculiar and unusual when it happened. It was accidental on terms of my side because that material was placed in the wine, and there's no reason you would do that from a culture standpoint. You know, wine doesn't sit around for 10 years to grow pathogens. It's not in a medium or environment that you think would be productive for pathogenic growth. It's primarily alcohol-based, so there's a lot of very interesting questions that come about here in terms of the wine chemistry down the road. But the very same material that is useful to extract this material is also found to be useful as a culture medium. And that's an interesting paradox here, but it is the case. So we see a photograph where the material is simply placed in the wine, and it was an accident. I just let it sit. I do that sometimes, and I wasn't expecting anything. But it sat for several weeks undisturbed. And you would think nothing in the world is happening. You have no reason to think anything's going to happen. But after several weeks, things do happen. And in really almost every case I can think of, I don't know really if I have any exceptions yet, but I'm sure there's always some. It's just a pace of life. But if you watch that material for a couple weeks or whatever it's going to take, anywhere from 2 weeks to 6 weeks, there is a growth that occurs within wine, very unexpected. And these are the pictures now, the next tier down, we'll see, you know, you have one, two, three. The auger is the white material. That's its first form. It progresses through three levels. The first initial layer is pure white. The middle layer is a green color, and that's what you're starting to look at right now, or what we're looking at are those photographs immediately below that have a very greenish color to them. And then ultimately will turn very dark, deep black. And by the way, when you were talking about worldly consideration of distribution, one of the subjects that was participated in this study is a resident of China and has been for several years. And that individual produced a material quite fully, let's say. So that's from the other side of the globe. There's actually no reason at all to think that there is any restriction with respect to human local.
That's species-wide, then.
On this. But if we see those pictures now, we see a mid-level development of this culture. It's very unusual material. I would claim at this point that this is a what I would call a primary pathogenic form. It's beyond just a maybe to me. I've seen this stuff dozens of times now under great detail and studied extensively under the microscope. In comparison, what you have to do, again, is compare that culture with the original material that you're starting with and look for any kind of parallels. And this is where it gets becomes more and more complex and more astounding, I suppose, as we go along, the degree of correspondence. So that mid-level shows a significant culture growth, which is representative of a mid-level maturation of this pathogenic form. And it, you know, it has some peculiarities that it gets pretty thick. It can get up to, it goes as thick as a dish, the dish will allow. There's really no stopping of it other than the boundary of the container, which it's contained within. It can be up to an inch thick there, only because the container is an inch thick, has numerous deep folds in it. Unfortunately, the conclusion is that this material is what is in our body, and I think anyone that actually saw this material in live would find it very distressing and would certainly be asking some questions at the very least. What are we really dealing with? And then you should be asking, why is that growing on wine to that level? What is going on with that chemistry? So that's the mid-level growth. Now, the next photograph is an important turning point, and I have to try to get through all the, we have to watch our time. I have to get through all of these photographs by about a quarter after is what I'm guessing. So I'll do my best, but speed me up if I lose it. But this next photograph is a turning point in terms of the research, and it shows a test tube with some material in it being heated up. And whether you want to call this accidental, again, however these things happen, that's not my, I don't have a time to try and inquire in our discussion now how these discoveries happen, but we're fortunate that some of them do at least. Unfortunately, they take 10 years and decades to happen when they should have taken days or months or weeks. But something happened, and that was I subjected this culture material, like we saw in the mid photographs there, I subjected it to two changes. The first would be I subjected it to sodium hydroxide, an alkali, a common name, a lye. I subjected that culture to a solution of lye in that test tube. That's the first part. The second thing that was done was I also subjected that solution to heat. Basically up to the boiling point. The process at this point right now brings it right up to the boiling point and holds it about that temperature for anywhere, call it from 15 minutes, 5 to 15 minutes to try to hold it right at that level, sort of like simmering away. And when you start out, the progression is as follows. When you put this material in the, put it in water first, and it'll be, in completely insoluble, there'll be no reaction of any kind taking place. When you put in the lye, and that's what I've worked on most recently, is to get a handle on the strength of that lye, and that's been done, and we'll talk about that another day, but we know how strong that material, the solution is now.
Yeah.
But when you subject it to lye or sodium hydroxide at a certain concentration, the first part of the reaction will occur, and what you'll see is that those filaments will turn very dark to black, first of all. And you'll see what you think is some decomposition taking place. It looks like it's starting to break apart a little bit. Now, there's some tie-ins here. We don't have time to go into all of it, but we go way, way back to those environmental samples, EPA filaments, one of the things that was discovered about that was that it reacts to an alkali. It's about the only thing in the world I could get it to react to. But I did get that filament sample way back in the very early days to react to an alkali material. And that was reported, and it's been hanging out for a dozen years until we bring in ties now that we never really could have foreseen. And the tie-ins are going to be with keratin and proteins and what breaks down that particular protein. That's what's going to be the tie for people to be looking at. But that's the first part of the reaction that turns black, and it looks like it's starting to decompose, but that decomposition is not complete at all. It just doesn't go very far. But it does affect it in some way. When you subject it to heat, a very interesting and significant change occurs, and that is that solution will turn a rather, let's call it, deep, dark red color. And enough to the point where it certainly appears, well, there's no question about it, there's further decomposition that takes place. But my interpretation at this point is that you have some kind of denaturization process taking place in the proteins. Heat is important in producing the final result that we're going to continue on with in our discussion and the work. Now, I'll just say this in passing in terms of, I'm not trying to draw the conclusion from this, but I'll just give you the anecdotal reaction that occurred here. When this material turned dark red, I looked at it and I said, you know, it actually looks like blood. Now, I'm not trying to say it's blood at that point. I'm just saying, you know, it actually looked like blood. I showed that to another individual. This individual had no idea what I was doing, not a clue what I was doing. And I just showed them the test tube, and I said, what does it look like? What does this look like to you? And she said, it looks like blood. And it looks like blood in solution. In other words, the degree would depend upon, you know, how much lye, how much water, and this type of thing. But certainly from the visual side, it has a very unusual and unexpected appearance when subjected to this chemical process. Okay. Now, that, and we're still there, right, Jeff?
Yep.
Yeah, great. Thanks very much. This represents a turning point because once this chemical change and transformation had occurred, this material was placed under the microscope. Now, what's different here and important is that you now have a solution. A solution entirely changes access, the chemistry, potential development of cultures, changes everything in aqueous chemistry versus solid chemistry, and I have to say offers major advantages.
Wow. All right. We'll take our break on that note and come back. So it's beginning, Clifford, to look like there are certainly man-made components to this at the very least, correct?
Everything is saying that. We have something that's been engineered here.
All right, very good. Thank you. Be right back with all of you folks in just a few minutes. Okay, we're back in hour number two with Clifford Carnicom. I hope you're online with us and following this. It's an update on Morgellons through the eyes, mind, and research of Clifford Carnicom. And Clifford, go right ahead. We have a lot to get through. So, by the way, go to the Rents.com guest section and click on Clifford's name. Go to Carnicom.com, and right in the middle above the six pictures of chemtrails, you'll see Morgellons, a status report. Click on that, and you'll be right up to speed with us. Scroll down about two-thirds of the way on the page, and we are in that group of color photographs. Go ahead, Clifford.
Thank you very much, Jeff. I'm watching my time here. I'll do the best I can. Two more segments to get through on this before we shift over to the other paper. The importance of the process that we just described involving sodium, an alkali and heat is twofold. The first is that process is giving us a window. It's giving us a means of viewing the internal components of these fibers and filaments. From my side, at least, for the first time. I have had, call it glimpses and tantalizing glimpses of most everything that is now being solidified with the more recent research, but it's been a very arduous and slow process. This chemical and heat process gives us a direct line, I would say, into the internal components and aspects of these filaments. And from my standpoint, that is a significant advancement and reduces a great deal of the inhibitors and barriers that we have had up to this point for more than 10 years. The second is that it shifts the problem of examination over to that of solution or aqueous-based chemistry as opposed to solid chemistry. And there are major advantages when we shift over into the solution world. And enough said on that, it becomes apparent as we go along. These are the two benefits of this process that I see at this point. Now, the next set of photographs, there's about 10 of them. They are a record of that first insight, and I would call it direct, a direct insight and link into the internal components of these filaments. There's been a lot of analysis which indicates certain things are there, but this is now at the level of direct observation. And we don't see everything here. That's why I have to get to the photographs at the bottom also. But we see enough that really captures our attention. And we see three of four things that eventually become known. And if you look at these photographs, the first thing you will see is you will see an erythrocytic form that occurs. Now as a result of a solution again, no longer a filament. What we're doing is taking a single drop of that concentrated solution, taking it from the bottom, and placing that under the scope and examining the components that are revealed. And one of the components will be an erythrocytic form. Now, there has always been a reconstitution process here. Every single thing, any time we're talking about erythrocytes, there is a reconstitution.
What does that mean? What do you mean, reconstitution?
Come back to form. Come to full form.
I understand the word, but in this case, I want to be sure I'm following.
Yeah, this is where it's coming from. See, if we trace this back from the very beginning, the original form always appears to be something of a desiccated nature or spore-like. It's
right, well,
something that has been reduced.
Right. That interfaces with your original research and discoveries over 10 years ago.
This is correct. This is correct. And so, you know, we need to be aware there is always a process of reconstitution that's taking place. And, you know, there are statements in other papers that you'll just have to refer to. We could talk all night
sure,
on it.
Sure, sure, sure. No,
it's extraordinary that this is taking place in this chemical, this hostile environment that we're talking about.
Right.
First of all, you don't grow blood, first of all. Second of all, you don't have blood in a hostile environment like this.
Doesn't work. No.
Okay? So, you know, hence questions of, you know, engineered formations here. But nevertheless, there is reconstitution that takes place, and that process is variable and not perfectly defined. People need to know that. So there are varying degrees of this take place, and that'll be one of the future research topics, is to see if that process can be stabilized so you get the same result every time. There has been variation, and there is variation, but there's enough known, looks like, where they can be reconstituted to a sufficient level using reasonable and accessible means, namely saline environment particularly. But nevertheless, one of the first forms that shows, I got to hustle through this, but one of the first forms, it's direct, apparent, and clear, is that of an erythrocytic form. The second would be, you now see the filament, but fascinating photographs to me, the two beneath that single erythrocytic form.
Uh-huh.
And that is, you have the filament, and I don't know how else to say it. It looks like you have captured it in the act of basically being busted open.
Right.
And you will see the erythrocytic structures emanating from
the
broken fiber.
Like they're being released.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I don't know how much more direct you can get at this standpoint. That photograph on the right is just astounding. You can see where the sheath has been ripped open.
Yep.
And then you see the cellular forms emerging from it. That's, to me, an astounding photograph.
It is.
Below it, you have three photographs which add another aspect to this, which in the end, even though we haven't talked about it tonight, you will see that I have a great deal of attention focused on a particular structure, a very small structure. And if we look back at my papers, I started calling attention to that, close to at least six, right. 7 years ago. It's real intense now in terms of my interest and focus on it.
Well, again, these photographs you're seeing are at 8,000 power.
That's right. These are roughly about there. That's correct. And later on, we'll see there's been another change on the scope work. But those next three set of photographs, you see erythrocytic forms, and I admittedly they're a little bit vague there. It's the best I can do under the circumstances. This stuff is not all
It's amazing what
defined,
you've done.
But they are the form that we're speaking of.
Uh-huh.
Now, inside of those cells, you see a smaller structure, and I call it a submicron structure, and tremendous interest and attention I am devoting to this particular structure because it goes way back. If you look at the papers, I started reporting on blood anomalies.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the first things that I started calling attention to, is that there is a submicron structure repeating itself in the blood samples. Attempts were made to postulate what type of structure that might be. You will see early on the suggestion of a chlamydia pneumonia particular being mentioned. And as we go along through the evening, I'll throw out the words. The truth is we don't know what they are. Let's just say that. We don't know what they are. But my best suggestion I can offer at this time, I would call them candidates. There's two candidates that we should be looking at, I think, very strongly, at least a first pass through. That is what I would call a chlamydia-like organisms. Okay? And the reason I say like is because, first of all, we don't know what they are, and second of all, we have, to me, obvious modification in engineering that has taken place here. These cannot be in any kind of conventional form whatsoever. But there's quite a few characteristics of this chlamydia structure, particularly, let me say one that's real important. Chlamydia pneumonia is something that feeds off the energy of our cells. It's not sufficient to metabolize by itself. It needs the energy of a cell, and this is why it is an intracellular organism. It exists within the cell. Makes it much, much harder to detect because the immune system does not know it's there because it's inside the cell.
Wow.
You start seeing these now.
Mm-hmm.
This is coming from a broken down filament, and you see these now for the first time directly, that which has been seen before manifesting in actual blood, but it appears to be the identical structure, the best I can tell. I've done a lot of work on size measurement of this thing. We're going to have a range in the end from estimated now of 0.2 to about 0.8 microns. Best estimate is 0.5 microns. Size is incredibly important as a distinguishing characteristic of any structure or organism, and that size measurement is extremely important, and I am only limited at this point by the resolution of the equipment that I'm using. There's no excuse at all that we don't know exactly what that is.
What size are we looking at, Clifford, here? The smaller objects within the round or erythrocytic form. What is that? What size would that be?
Yeah, it's submicron. Should be the best estimate would be about a half micron.
So it's viral size.
Right on the borderline. Yeah, the stuff that's going on is right on the borderline.
Okay.
It'd be generally a little bit large on the viral side and generally pretty small on the bacterial side.
I really salute you for this work. I'm amazed what you've done. Just amazed. All right, hold on. We'll be right back. Another historic conversation of what I like to call citizen science with our citizen scientist Clifford Carnicom. We're learning things that the feds ought to be telling us, but of course they're not our feds, they're working for somebody else. We shall continue. Okay, back with Clifford. Go right ahead, Clifford, looking at the pictures with you. Amazing size. We're looking at things, ladies and gentlemen, that are down in the viral neighborhood, okay? That's where we are.
Yeah, it's right on that borderline between viral size and the smaller bacterial size. Okay, I'm only about 10 or 15 minutes late by the time I finished, so maybe not too bad considering all things considered here. But I have to finish this segment, and we have four more photographs to get through. These are the four final photographs of the paper. Now, these four final photographs are important to me because, number one, they show the advantage of shifting over to an aqueous-based chemistry as opposed to a solid. Because, okay, to me, there is an amazing thing that takes place here. And the question came up. The question came up in that, all right, if you think that you have broken down these fibers and you're working with the internal components of those fibers, and you're now in a solution-based medium here, what if, and would it not be possible to consider that you could now culture from that solution as opposed to culture from the original solid filament material? What would happen, and could you culture from the solution form? And this is what these final four photographs show. It was unknown what would happen, but indeed it does happen. And the process is this. When you have this lye-based and heated solution that's now been broken down, if you take a single drop, and this is the huge difference, if you take a single drop of that solution and place it in a wine medium and allow sufficient time, on average it looks like you're dealing with maybe two to three weeks, and you may not think anything's happening, but you have to watch it and see. After 2 to 3 weeks, transformations will take place. And what, in the end, what happens is you have a complete cycle of growth that takes place from a single drop of this solution. And this is the point where the four components, what I would call four components of the filament, for the first time are readily and positively identified, at least as to form, because the development process can now be observed. And what happens is there are various stages of development that takes place, and in that process, four physical forms emerge. You put the solution in, number one. Nothing appears to be happening there, and you let it sit. After several days, a week to 2 weeks, you'll see a little fuzzy, hazy material, a dark material. You can actually see that in the top left of those four photographs. It's the one that says, this photograph is unique and important in the fact that it represents the first successful complete cycle of the filament culture process.
It's got
if
the dark red.
If you look at
red.
The wine in the background, you'll see this hazy, dark material. That is the very first stage. Basically, as it was developing, I put it under the scope on pretty much a daily basis. The first thing you see develop is the submicron structure. Again, I'm going to use the name for the act of convenience in a discussion of a chlamydia-like organism. This is what appears first. And you're talking about appearing in massive quantities. Okay? Now, those, we didn't go over those other photographs, but the photographs immediately above the one that we're speaking of show examples of that chlamydia-like structure in greater numbers than we just looked at. You know, we looked at the one inside the cell. You have some photographs that focus on those chlamydia-like structures immediately above. This is number one. The second development, you'd have to go to the lower right photograph, and you have what I've made reference to it in the past, and it's even more strongly confirmed now. That is what I would call a pleomorphic form. It looks sort of ribbon-like. And in that lower right photograph, you will see a combination of the chlamydia-like structure, an oval structure measuring roughly a half micron, anywhere from 3/10 to 7/10 of a micron. But you'll see these sort of ribbon-like structures, somewhat undefined shape. This is what pleomorphic refers to. It means many-shaped, many-formed. And the strongest candidate that comes out with that type of development that I can find right now is mycoplasma. Mycoplasma does not have a cell wall. And that's the reason that it assumes many forms. It doesn't have the boundary to contain or hold it in, so it develops into different forms. These are two leading candidates for me of identification would be a mycoplasmic form and a chlamydia-like form. So this is number two. And so the four components in total are, and then the last progression after you see the pleomorphic form come in,
right,
is you would then see the filament form,
mm-hmm,
on the top of the wine, and that's your photograph. Those two middle photographs show the complete cycle where you have the original, mm-hmm, original filament that you,
mm-hmm,
started with,
mm-hmm,
all based on a single solution, a single drop of this solution.
Wow.
So the
all right.
Four,
go ahead.
Go ahead, Jeff.
No, I was going to ask you, before you go on, we have a break coming up here. Let's wrap it up as we are right now, and then we have to pause. So let's take this time to review what you've just said.
Those four forms, then, in total, are the chlamydia-like structure,
mm-hmm,
the pleomorphic structure,
mm-hmm,
the erythrocytic structure, and the bounding or encasing filament structure. These are the four forms that I would regard as comprising what I see as a primary pathogenic form.
Wow. All right. Pathogenesis has been demonstrated, or is it supposed at this time?
You'd call it my proposition.
Okay.
My proposition. Something, yeah, in our bodies that's causing a big problem that shouldn't be there.
Very good. Okay, well said. Okay, rather historic information and revelations as always with Clifford. And we'll be back with more in just a few minutes. Okay, back again with you, and Clifford. Go ahead, Clifford, please. Half an hour to go.
Yeah, thanks very much, Jeff. I'll be cramming on this. I have, I think, probably about 20, 25 minutes to cover seven topics that I believe that these topics are probably going to form the basis of several months of research in the future at the current pace that I can progress. And this paper is really mostly for us. It's not at all complete, and it's for us tonight. This paper is called Future Research Topics, and that also has a main headline on the homepage of carnicum.com.
Got it.
And hopefully people can find that. Understand it's not complete. It's not intended to be complete, and you'll see my statement to that effect. And the photographs that are up here are primarily up here for Jeff and I tonight, to give you an idea of the types of the type of work that needs to be done, and this work now is emerging very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Most of these subjects have evolved very strongly just over the last couple of weeks, and the list just keeps growing. And I don't know actually what's going to happen. I don't know how I'm ever going to catch up on this.
Well, it seems like Clifford, the more you look, the more you find.
Yeah, and it's really opening up now, from what I can see on things. And this will not at all do justice to this, and you know, maybe we'll talk again a little bit later, but I at least wanted to mention these topics that are emerging, and hopefully people can understand the potential implications of them.
There have to be people listening in who are otherwise involved with science and in the world of forensics and pathology who are listening very carefully and will pay attention to this, and we're going to tell them how to get in touch with you and the Institute and how to help support it, too, in a few minutes. Go ahead.
Thanks, Jeff. So this will be really fast, but here we go. The first one is called, number one, I'll read them and then we'll come back. Number one, a mechanism of blood damage. Number two, live cell and live culture analysis. Number three, internal EPA filament structure. This actually goes back to Jeff's question at the very beginning of our talk tonight. Number four, DNA extractions, initial questions. Number five, laboratory test of immediate need, of which there'll be 13 items under that, just first level through. Number six, inhibition and mitigation trials.
Mm-hmm.
And number seven, ethical and legal issues of medical and laboratory disclosure. These are the topics in case I miss them tonight, and I'll just have to refer you to the readers to the list and to realize that this is what's at least on my mind, and what appears to be the basis of several months of work before we even get started on other questions that are coming up. Now, let's try to hit some of these. First one, a mechanism of blood damage. First, you do have a set of photographs there, and you have a caption of that, a mechanism of blood damage.
Mm-hmm.
Again, these are not described. This is only for us tonight, basically.
Sure.
But you see one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine photographs. Now, another thing going on is I do have a new camera, and it's helping out. I'm up a little bit. I'm actually running from 10 to extreme would be 30,000. You know, I'm just limited by equipment here.
Uh-huh.
But I've actually boosted it up from the 5 to 10 range to 10 to 30 at extreme. And 10 to 15 is more representative of what can be done now as opposed to 5 to 10. And this kind of, it makes a difference, folks. technology does make a difference, whether we like it or not. And we are very seriously limited and hampered by what we can see or not see. But these first four photographs, they revealed something very important, and it could not be seen at this level without the new equipment. What happened was I looked at blood of an individual, and these particular cells at this time, red blood cells, were really looking quite, let's call it uniform. They were looking healthy. Now, what was interesting is this same individual 2 years ago displayed all of the anomalies that I'm speaking of in blood. People will have to go back to all those papers on the blood that I wrote up. But you have the preponderance of this submicron structure within the blood, and you have the preponderance of that pleomorphic form within the blood. And I called a lot of attention to that several years ago. This particular individual had all of those things to a serious degree, and this individual has no skin manifestations of any kind. Now you had a situation where that individual's blood was looking pretty decent. And, you know, that's another whole topic about, you know, that's what number 6 and 7 are about on this list. We won't have time to get there tonight. But nevertheless, there was a change in that particular individual's status, it appeared. Now, because of the camera that was available, something was noticed. And it was the fine degree of camera difference that made this possible, and that is, even though the cells themselves looked quite uniform and had integrity, in the surrounding material of the cell, basically what's going to be the plasma, it was observed that there was this very same chlamydia-like structure external to the cell, and it was there in large quantity.
Oh.
And this was never seen before. Hmm. And this is your photograph on the lower left of that first set of four. The first photograph, let me back up a little bit. Top left, uniform cell, best condition seen, individual is showing progress. Right photograph, same individual a year and a half ago, showing the internal structures after a stain process that degrades the cells but reveals the chlamydia-like structures in great detail.
Okay.
That's top right. Top left, revelation of the chlamydia-like structures external to the cells, but in large numbers and quantities in the surrounding medium, basically the plasma, which had never been seen before. And you're talking about just the fine difference of focus makes all the difference between whether you see this or don't see this.
Right.
It had never been seen before.
Right.
Now, that might be interpreted as a significant disappointment, but also that of enlightenment. In other words, indeed, there was change in the status of the cells, but you also saw that the basic core problem, which was reported on to begin with, is very much in place, regardless of that apparent progress in the cells. The lower right is a blow-up. That's the one that would go up to 30. That's actually digital zoom, so you're not actually gaining anything there, but that's up to about 30 grand, and it shows 30K, and that shows those structures in the best detail I can bring up. And certainly you can see their size relative to that blood cell, and you can see very clearly you're operating at the submicron range, because that cell will be 6 to 7 microns across. Now.
Okay, hang on, Clifford.
Yeah, boy, I'm running out.
Yeah, it's all right. These images just bring all kinds of questions. You must, I don't know how you sleep at night. 3E, the fibers, 3F, 3G, oh my. All right, hold on, we'll be right back. Okay, we're back. Now, for all of you out there who admire the work that Clifford is doing and has been doing for well over a decade on your behalf, our behalf, please support the Carnicom Institute. Go to carnicom.com if you want. That's an easy way to remember it. Look at the top. you'll see Carnicom Institute right there. It's a 5093C. Anything you donate is of a believable nature. And this man just got, just imagine what he could do with the dollars. I mean, he's done so much over the years with nothing. Just cobbling together things, technologies and abilities to do things that graduate university science labs spend big money to do. So remember, Carnicom Institute, please. And if you have any extra money at all and you want a tax write-off especially, that's where you might want to think about putting it. Go ahead, Clifford.
Yeah, thanks very much, Jeff. And I do want to clarify, we don't have 501c status yet. That's one of our first goals. We have nonprofit status in the state of Mexico.
Never mind then.
And we need help for that.
Donate anyhow.
Yeah. It is nonprofit, but we need help actually
Understand.
On the 501.
Very good.
Summary statement from that first set of photographs on the future research topics paper is that the mechanism by which the blood is being damaged from this particular chlamydia-like structure or organism is apparent. And that is that these chlamydia-like structures are attracted to the external cell wall of the erythrocyte. They eventually attach to and start breaking down that cell wall. And those photographs will show that breakdown process quite clearly. If somebody takes the time to look at them. And the other piece of information on this particular set that shows sort of the seriousness of what we're talking about in terms of change, we talked about that top cell and how things looked pretty good even though we knew that the stuff was in the blood all the time. Well, just to let you know, the photograph on the lower left of that same set is that same individual 3 weeks later where the blood shows massive and rapid degradation and deterioration. So what we learn here is that the blood can change its state really quite rapidly, and you can have a very false illusion or impression if you try to latch on to a single interpretation or viewing of your blood. Radical changes occur, and I'll just say from an anecdotal level that it is true that this individual experienced some significant health concerns and issues over those 3 weeks. It is also a statement of fact that during the same period there were major aerosol operations that occurred during that same interval, and I won't draw the conclusions any further than is warranted under the circumstances. The middle section is called live blood cell analysis. This is brand new also, but it takes a lot of overhead to do this, but basically you have now a video available to you. This will show live blood cells. You have two videos of about a minute and a half. I would only ask that you study those videos very carefully and very closely. And what you will find if you watch them very closely, you will see this chlamydia-like structure external to the blood cells, basically a live form of what has been determined through stills over a period of many, many years. We do have live coverage, basically, of that, I don't know, interstitial, whatever they want to call it, plasma. You can see these things rotating. You'll see their attraction at times to the exterior cell wall, and you have to watch it very carefully. There's actually many more than you can see. We're limited by resolution. There's actually several of those structures occurring in each one of those videos. If you look carefully, a couple of them will come out with dark shadows, so you can see them more clearly. But watch them slowly and carefully, and you're going to see the actual process taking place. Number three. And I guess we'll hit this one the best we can in the time we have, and just go really quick on the other. But this ties in with your original question, Jeff, of do we have ties in with the airborne samples or filaments. Mm-hmm. Now, I've done a paper that suggested very, very strong linkage between these based on these same components that we're talking about. These four themes come out over and over and over. That is right. The chlamydia-like, the mycoplasma-like, the erythrocyte, and the bounding filament. And those early photographs first photographs on this set we're talking about now are from those earlier papers. And when I get time, those will be described. You have a bridge taking place here, and that's why the photograph of the test tube is shown again, because this heat and chemical process that we have spoken of tonight, which gave us a window into the body filament, the internal body filament, that has been applied one time only, because the amount of material available is extremely limited. It's been held on to for 10 years. By the way, we need more folks. If anybody has that material, We need some to do some more work on. But that EPA filament was subjected to the same chemical process that you and I talked about at length earlier tonight. Examination of that EPA filament after those chemical and thermal changes have taken place is the appearance of this same, this very same structure that we have speaking of in great length, by all appearances, is identical in size, nature, to the chlamydia-like organism that we are describing. And you will see those in the photographs with the red circles and the red arrows. These are coming from the EPA filament after they have been subjected to the identical lye and heat process that we described. And so we now have another chink in the coffin, I suppose, in the linkage between the airborne environmental sample that the EPA refused to identify over 10 years ago and the current findings from both blood as well as culture forms. I can only say they are identical in all appearances in size, shape, and form, and that measurement is not something that, let's say, is happening in a prevalent way in the universe to have this submicron, 0.5 micron circular structure occurring. And the fact that it would be in that filament should be of great question and interest to all of us. Okay, the last one, maybe the last, not next to last. So that's an extremely important topic, solidifying that linkage, which obviously says that work now needs to be done in great detail. We need that material if anybody has any samples, and it needs to be stockpiled so that the proper testing be done whenever when we ever do get into the proper laboratory. Number four is, this is a little bit unusual. And, you know, the business of Pandora's box, I don't know. You and I were talking about the extent of the human population and how all information indicates the general population has been affected.
Right.
Well, there's something a little bit strange, and it's too early to say, and that's why it's just listed as a research topic, because here's what happened. I got involved with DNA extraction. This is not as inaccessible as we might think it is. Now, it's one of those things where, like plasma, where you think, how would you do that? But it is actually possible for the layperson, if they care enough, to get involved in the process of DNA extraction, and it's not as complicated as we might think. It's unique and very interesting, but not incredibly complicated, and that's available to any of us that care enough. Those top two photographs are my first trial at that, and that's with very low magnification. Those are only 300 or 400, but that's DNA material on those top two photographs. And that happens to be from a banana. My first test was with a banana. I only go by observation. But what happened was I learned to extract DNA from a living form. I put it under the microscope. And then I put it under the microscope under more detail, as I usually do. As we know, most of my work, it all operates anywhere, starts at about 5K and goes up to 30K. That's where things happen from my side so far. I will only say that something caught my attention within that DNA material that I had, and that is I had the appearance of this very identical structure occurring. A submicron circular structure that matches, at least visually, the best I can do. I have this occurring within this DNA of this fruit. And all I did was record it as an observation. In fact, the first time I saw it, I just passed it off. I just said, okay, no commentary whatsoever, even in my own mind. I just registered. Okay? But it certainly was noted in my mind. You know, I'm seeing something that's quite familiar to me, and now I'm working with a fruit. I don't have an answer explanation. I'm simply presenting what I saw. I then went to a apple. Okay? And I found the same thing. Okay? I see this reoccurring structure, same identical form, that at this point I don't have any expectations of. Now, the truth is, we don't even touch DNA without an electron microscope. I'm not talking about seeing DNA, you know.
You're talking about proteins?
I'm just talking about the material itself. You can extract DNA in a visible, physical form enough to see and touch. But you cannot get into anything about the structure or detail of it,
sure,
or see it without getting into electron microscope. But what I'm saying is within that clustered material, that cluster of material, mm-hmm. I start seeing the same identical structure, and I see it across two fruit lines. Okay? The last two photographs are of human DNA, and they have a yellow cast. I just intensified a color. It's a false color. But basically, the human DNA shows the same thing, actually even on a grander scale if you look at it. Mm-hmm. But those last two photographs show, I would say, relatively large concentrations of this same type of form within the human DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And all I'm saying is questions, folks. I'm not making conclusions here. I'm just saying now we have some questions. And the questions now have to consider the possibility. You have to at least consider it, that we must extend our scope of consideration of what it is we're dealing with the existence of these very unique structures that have been reported on over and over and over for 10 years. We have to extend our scope of consideration to life in general, mm-hmm. at least be willing to extend it. And that is the topic of research, a topic, one of many, that is simply outlined for the future, and I'm not drawing any conclusions. I'm simply reporting, hey, this is what I see. It's the way the work has always gone, right? The very first time.
Oh, yeah.
I said there were erythrocytes. I said, I know this is, you know, we don't, doesn't make any sense, but this is what I'm seeing. This is one of those categories.
Wow. Well, all I can say is, I'm amazed at the progress you've made again, and I wish we could clone you into about 10 Cliffords, because you'd all be working 24/7, I know that.
Well, I appreciate all the work that's being done by everyone. I know there's a lot of different aspects to this. I just have my particular window with my particular time that I have available, and I appreciate all the efforts that are going on now out there towards serious and genuine work.
Very good. Thank you, Clifford. Good night.
Thanks a lot, Jeff.
Okay. Clifford Carnicom.